Hello and welcome to Dot Dot Doc. I'm Ian, your host, and I'm joined by Matt. Hello.
Hello.
Today we're going to be talking about The Wolfpack, which is a 2015 documentary by Crystal Mazel. We just watched it. I mean, we've seen it before. You've seen it years ago as well, right?
Yeah. Loved it. I think you probably introduced me to it back in, 2015?
Yeah.
I remember loving it, absolutely loving it at the time. And I remember at work, it was kind of all we would talk about with our kind of peer group, like on our lunch breaks and, well, during work as well. Just great. It was quite a joy to watch again. Been a long time.
So before we get into our thoughts, we should probably explain what the documentary is about. It's basically a documentary that follows six brothers and their family. And we find out that they've been confined to like a New York apartment for, I think it was like 13 years, wasn't it?
Yeah. Down on the Lower East Side
of New York. All the brothers, they're like really into film, like insanely into film, because that's their window to the outside world. Essentially, that's growing up. That's all they had, was like these films. I think in the documentary, they reference that they probably have over 5,000 films that they're just obsessed with. And it shows you them just kind of recreating the film scene for scene. And there's a part where one of the brothers is like typing up like the subtitles of the film, like bit by bit, just so they can, you know, recite the film.
It's so they've got a script to follow, basically, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. Like, as much as this kind of comes across like a, I don't know, like, there's ways of looking at this whole documentary as like, wow, like, I don't know. It's like, that looks like a, maybe I'm wrong in saying this, but it looks like a pretty fun damn childhood. Like, I would have loved to have been making movies as a youngster. True, I don't know if I'd weigh that up with being able to go outside and play with friends when I was a kid and, you know, kind of live a, you know, quote unquote normal life. But it does come across as so much fun. It comes across that they're having fun. But then I suppose if that's all that they know, then they've had to create that fun, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, we're only seeing like a speck of this life, and the most of the life that we see is them creating the films, them just having fun talking to the camera, who is, you know, like, it's a documentary filmmaker who's come in, so they have someone to talk to, so of course they're like having the time of their lives and whatnot. We do see footage from when they're younger, but I found out in an interview that most of that footage is from like family occasions, like birthdays and all that stuff. So, you know, they might look like they're fun, they're all dressed up and stuff. I don't think that was like every day.
No, I'm sure not. Like, I mean, obviously it comes through that they're homeschooled. You know, a lot of their day is probably, I would imagine, taken up by schooling. And their idea of normal schooling to them, although, you know, homeschooling isn't abnormal, it's a thing that goes on in the world. Plenty of children get homeschooled, so it's not abnormal by any means.
So one thing before we just move on, I did try to look up about teaching, like homeschooling in New York. I did wonder a couple of things. I wondered how much if you homeschool your own children, how much you would earn. According to this website, I'll post it in the links in the bottom, but you don't have to have any qualifications whatsoever to homeschool anybody, because you're obviously following the curriculum. You just have to teach that curriculum, and then as far as I can tell, you have, maybe occasionally might have to prove by sending like the work and stuff, but I couldn't find out the salary whatsoever. I couldn't find out. I looked around for a bit and I kind of just gave up in the end.
As far as
we can tell, that's the only money they had coming in was from their mum teaching.
Possibly they would get welfare if the father was out of work and wasn't working. I would imagine that they'd get some form of welfare check, especially being that there's seven children in the family. Like, we've not said yet, but there's a sister as well.
There's
the the other child, and she's the eldest child of all of them. But yeah, she's it's I would imagine, again, not being from the States, and unfortunately it's not something I've looked up, but I would imagine that they would get some form of welfare, like welfare checks sent, and you know, they would, in order to live off as well. So I guess with that, also with the income of homeschooling, you know, there must have been some money coming into the family.
Yeah, I love that the dad just doesn't want to work. He says that's like an oppression kind of thing. And
yeah, he talks a lot about from where he come from of being a free man. And like he has almost like a disdain for outside the outside world in New York City. Comes across that he's very scared of his children falling into the path of drugs and you know, into what some might call the sickness of society, and falling into that. He doesn't want that for them. And I suppose in his mind, keeping them in and keeping them locked up to a degree is his way of, I guess, showing love in his mind, however crazy that might sound. But I guess at trying to look at it through his eyes, then at least that's what I get from it. Doesn't mean to say I think it's right at all, but to try and like look through it through a different perspective and through someone else's eyes, that's what I get from it. There's definitely a deep form of control within him. Like I get that from the mother as well. Like she comes across kind of meek and almost like she's scared to take a stand, you know, against the husband and say, you know, this isn't right. But it comes across that she's been worn down over the years. That's my take anyway.
Yeah, the dad, I mean, I feel like the dad seems like a free spirit. Like it seems like almost maybe he had a culture shock when he come to New York, and
100%.
Like he, you know, he's like seen the streets, he's seen like all these people around him, and he's seen like how bad it can be, and he becomes like a bit of a recluse, and he kind of forces this upon his family from what I can tell. You know, like if he keeps them inside the apartment, keeps them watching films, he's kept them safe.
Yeah, like I think he even states at one point in the documentary that like outside in New York is like a jail. It's like inmates in a jail. So like he just has this, his view, like you said, it's obviously one massive culture shock, and his view on what society should be isn't what he's found in New York City. So it is, I mean, there is a degree of, you have to, I think if you're, you know, if you're kind of taking apart a documentary, then you have to kind of see it from different characters' perspectives. Again, whether you think it's right or wrong, you know, if you're trying to delve into the documentary, you need to try and understand like their point of view to a degree. And I think that comes through definitely in the documentary, but also what comes through is that by him doing that, is he's taking away, as much as he thinks he's giving, he's also taking away a massive part of their childhood.
Yeah, I mean, social interaction with other children, that's important. I mean, luckily they have themselves, you know, there's enough of them to interact with a different person each day in that. But
definitely. I mean, I think they'd be a lot worse off, say, now, in the future, like now, if it was just, say, a two-sibling family, or if it was an only child, because they'd have had no one. And it would have been, they would have, well, it could send someone crazy. Like, it's just, they definitely wouldn't have any social skills whatsoever. So yeah, definitely they're lucky to have each other.
We see that in the documentary, one of the brothers, how they finally kind of get out and about, was one of them just decides to go out. He opens the door, he dresses all in black and wears a Mike Myers from Halloween mask. Yeah. And he wanders around the blocks near his house, and he goes in the bank, he goes in the shop. You know, this is the first time he's properly been out on his own. And then someone calls the police on him.
Yeah.
Because
He's out in a Mike Myers mask going into a bank.
Yeah, but this
I mean, you go into a bank wearing a mask, like, you know, people are going to look upon that as very strange, especially if it's not Halloween.
It was January, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So if you're out in the streets on Halloween dressed as Mike Myers, you know, maybe people will turn a blind eye. But January time, yeah, people are going to think that's very odd and maybe a cause for suspicion.
Yeah, plus he said that he was wearing it because he didn't want anybody to recognize him.
Yeah. And I've also kind of found out since that he said the reason he chose Michael Myers, John Carpenter's Halloween, the reason he chose that mask and that kind of boiler suit to dress up in is because the character Michael Myers is unstoppable. Like, if you've seen the Halloween films, like, spoiler alert, he kind of gets killed and comes back and comes back and comes back, and he's unstoppable. And trying to think of this lad's name. It's his name's Mukunda. He basically says that on this day, he felt unstoppable. Like, him leaving the apartment that day for the very first time, he wanted to feel unstoppable. Like, he was totally going against everything his father had taught him throughout life. Like, you don't step foot outside these doors. And for him to do this, like, I think he said, like, his father was grocery shopping at the time. And he'd usually be out for about 3 hours, 2 to 3 hours when he'd done groceries. So he saw this as his opportunity to step outside into the world. But he needed that. He needed that persona to feel unstoppable. So again, like, psychologically, deep down, like, that was a mask for him, almost a layer of protection. Like, yeah, he was stepping outside, but he needed that, you know, almost that thing from inside, from his safe space, that kind of comfort blanket to enable him to do what he was doing. But he said he felt unstoppable. But yeah, like, I think you were saying, like, the police were called, weren't they? Mm.
And there's a part in the documentary, because it's weird, because it feels like they didn't mention he wore that because he wanted to feel unstoppable, but he does mention in the documentary that, oh, can I repel bullets?
Yeah, so I think he was thinking that when he saw the police coming towards him. And in his mind, again, because he's just seen movies, and movies are kind of like a complete distortion on reality, you know, as reality really is. So in his mind, he's probably thinking, oh my God, they're coming for me. They're going to shoot. They're going to shoot first, ask questions later. And he felt, I think he says in the documentary, he felt like he was Michael Myers. At that moment, he felt like he was Michael Myers. And he asked himself that question, like, can I repel bullets? And just that is, wow. Like, that is so out there. Like, what an imagination.
I must admit, the brothers do become the characters. Like, when they're doing Reservoir Dogs at the beginning, the voice is even, like, on point. And, like, because I've seen, Reservoir Dogs, like, recently, and, like, the way one of them's trying to be, is it Mr. Orange? Like, Tim Roth in it?
Mm-hmm.
How he's speaking, it looks almost the same. It's, like, insane. It's kind of like, it's just every little mannerism from the film. They've religiously watch these films over and over again, so it's incredible.
That's what I mean, though. Like, I think that shows that they have, by seeing these films so many times, that they have picked up on accents and like you say, mannerisms. Because I'd say with pretty much every kind of like sort of script that they do in this, it's pretty much top-notch acting. It's believable. Which, for just some kids in a New York apartment, you wouldn't expect them to be that good. But that's almost been, I guess you could say, another part of their homeschooling, is these movies. That's taught them about life. That's all they know. But yeah, like, I'd say a lot of directors, like, seeing that would go, okay, yeah, these guys can act, you know? And I'd say they can act, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. Was it like one of them when they're doing Pulp Fiction and the John Travolta voice is like pretty much spot on. Like, him talking to Jules, like, in the back.
Yeah.
So their Batman costume is incredible. I think that's absolutely amazing. I was like in awe of that Batman costume. And they said it was made out of cereal boxes and yoga mats.
How amazing is that as well? Like not only is their acting kind of pretty much top notch, you know, to a degree where they've had no actual acting training. Not only that, but they're prop makers as well. Like each of them could have careers in this type of thing. Like they've basically made a full bat suit out of household goods. Like that's incredible. Absolutely incredible.
I seen from one of the interviews that the director basically said that they, for like Halloween, they prepare like a month, like over the whole month to build up to this. So I remember, you know, seeing the Halloween bit in the documentary where they have like drawings from like films all over the walls. They've got like, you know, the props, they got the costumes, everything. And that's taken like a whole month of preparation to build up to this one night where they just like, you know, dance about, have fun, make, you know, their own little movies and stuff. But, you know, it must be amazing. Like, you know, they've looked out the window around this time and they're like, oh, people are playing dress up and stuff outside.
Like I've read since that like Halloween was their favorite holiday. Like it was kind of the only one they truly celebrated, and they kind of went all out for, which comes across as well in the documentary. But yeah, it was most of the stuff I've seen since in interviews and things like that have been from Mukunda. He seems to be, or at least from what I found, the most kind of outspoken. Since the documentary's ended. And I heard that from him, that, you know, he said that that was the one holiday that we all really, really looked forward to. But then I guess, again, it's because it makes you be creative. And that is kind of their life. That was their lifestyle, was this kind of imaginative, creative lifestyle. You know, it's no wonder that they loved that holiday.
Do you reckon... let's say they had access to the internet and a computer in there. Would they would they be as creative, as productive?
It's probably not. I mean, it's hard to tell. I mean, you know, for starters, I don't know whether they did at any point or not. I would imagine they didn't, because their father probably, if he's worried about the outside world, you know, he probably doesn't want them in like crazy chat rooms or anything like that. So I'd imagine they didn't. But I mean, I couldn't say yes or no, because, you know, there's very creative people in the world and they have access to the internet.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
You couldn't say that they wouldn't be. But at the same time, it can be a huge distraction. What you could say kind of, to a degree, cures boredom. And sometimes when you are at your most creative is when you are bored and when you need something to, you know, fill that time and feel like you've achieved something. And that's kind of the birth of creation, I think.
You kind of look at it and, you know, people used to say like, oh, TV brought your mind and that. And they definitely had access to TV.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that's
a lot of TV.
Yeah, a lot of TV. And I know that they used to record some of their films on, you know, like on VHS off the TV when they come on. So that's how they had access to like loads of stuff. I know that they used to find like their favorite directors. So they would watch a film and they'd be like, oh, like Quentin Tarantino, he's amazing. What else has he done? And they would say, the dad would go out and buy him, you know, more films, because obviously he's going to encourage that. But I know that his dad was trying, well, their dads were trying to, the dad, not the their dads, not the multiple dads. He was trying to push them towards being in the band, like being like a like a metal band, or because he seen that as, you know, the ultimate form of freedom for them, you know, like instead of getting like a real job tied down with that, you know, they could be in a band and like, you know, tour around, see the world. And you see that.
Yeah, which... I mean, that's understandable, but also like you could look at that in a way of, yeah, it's freedom to be in a band. Also, you could look at it in the eyes of perhaps that was his dad's way of thinking, you know, like the Jackson Five, like they were kind of all forced into this band and their childhood was completely taken away and their parents got rich off of that. So you could look at that as a way of the dad going, well, this is an easy way for me to make money. I'm in complete control of these children. They will do as I say. So you could look at it that way as well.
Yeah, I suppose they both had their childhood stolen in that sense. You know,
you could make a contrast to it, definitely.
And I'd say them being like in a big band, making money, is the dad trying to force ambition upon the kids so he doesn't have to work?
Yeah, it's almost like making them live his dream for him. There's many ways you could look at it, but I also look at the fact that it was the father. Like, again, you could watch this documentary and just see it through the eyes of, okay, well, the father's the bad guy in this. But in another sense, like, he introduced them to film. That seems to have become a huge part of their life, even today, like afterwards. So you could look at it as, again, it's tough to try and shine a good light on the father in this documentary at all. But I guess you could try and pick those things from it and say, well, yeah, he's given them that window of opportunity, I guess.
I don't know. That's kind of like, it's a bit of a grain of salt. It's like kind of like saying, you know, I've imprisoned you in this house, but hey, I'll give you films. And obviously it doesn't look like they've had any kind of, there's not been like an age rating. It's not like, oh, right now you're 15, you can watch this. It looks like, you know, they could watch 18s and stuff from the get-go. So
yeah, but I'm not gonna lie, I watched Scream, which I think was a 15 at maybe 11 or something like that, and when I was like a little kid, like 5 maybe, I remember being over a friend's house who was slightly older than me and watching one of the Freddy Krueger movies. Like, it shit me up. I had nightmares for weeks, but I watched it. Like, I never really had that thing on me, like, from my parents, where it was like, oh no, you can't watch this. I mean, obviously there would probably be a degree, you know, like, I wouldn't be able to watch anything truly crazy, you know, the stuff that maybe only adults should be watching, if you catch my drift. But like, I never really had that on me, like, you know, I guess because I had older siblings as well. A lot of the time I would like maybe even sneak watch what they were watching, like Stephen King stuff and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't think I don't know if I had anything like that when I was a kid, in terms of, I think I did kind of, I was like, I stuck to the age ratings and stuff just because, oh, got to be careful.
You were a good boy.
Just, I don't remember so much. I mean, I remember watching some films and then just be like, oh, fucking hell, that was a big mistake, and having like nightmares and stuff over it. But
yeah.
What can you do? I mean, usually, as you said, it's like stopping around a mate's house and you're watching something that's like, you know, you've convinced their parents to rent out like 18s, like, you know, these super violent like action films and stuff. And you're like, yeah.
Like,
The police going to kick down the door any second and come in. Talking about that. So at one point in the documentary, the police barge in and they basically kind of hear that there's like a possibly guns in the apartment, and they put everybody in handcuffs and like put the mum in handcuffs and put everybody in handcuffs. And they search through the place to find weapons, and they obviously find all the replica guns that the brothers have made, and all the weapons and all the costumes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And one thing I did wonder was, how isn't this a regular thing? Because they must have caused so much like noise in that apartment throughout those 13 years, you know, like there's a part where they're all jumping around and like, you know, dancing the music and stuff. I don't know how New York apartments are, but my apartment, if my neighbors are doing that.
Yeah, I think, I don't know for sure, but I would take a guess that maybe they lived in a fairly kind of poor part of New York City. And maybe it was kind of like New York, like I've never been. I'd love to go to New York. I've got family in New York. I should ask them. But New York, like from depictions I've always seen, it is always kind of like that loud kind of, you know, I'm walking here kind of thing, you know?
Gunshots in the background. And, yeah.
No, but you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of how it is. They're New Yorkers. Like, they just get on with it. So, yeah, I I can see why it wouldn't have been a regular thing. But then I guess as well, if there's been rumors that there's guns in the apartment, then obviously the police have to do something, you know, before something truly bad happens. But yeah, imagine being the police and finding all that in there, like thinking you're going to find all these weapons and you're finding cardboard weapons. Like,
I mean, that's cereal box thing. Weapons. That's probably like a common thing. Like, you know, kids are in England with like, was it BB guns or even cap guns? And you know, like you're on their own.
Guns.
I remember when I was a kid, I was running around with like a cap gun and stuff. You know, you're playing like, you know, just God knows what. And
Cowboys and Indians, yeah, cops and robbers.
Yeah, I'd say cops and robbers more. Like, it wouldn't be cowboys and Indians so much here. But yeah, you'd run around with guns and stuff like that. And then like a little while later, you'll see like a police like car turn up because they've heard that there's kids playing around with guns and stuff, which is like super unlikely here anyway. You know, you're more likely to get stabbed than anything.
Well, nowadays.
Yeah, I just thought they would end up getting like noise complaints galore living there. That's one thing I did find out though. So the apartment, I was trying to look at how big it was, and then I watched this clip of like almost like a documentary by, I don't know, it might have been ABC or something like that, as you mentioned. It's like a news channel. It was like a news reporter.
Was it like 20 for 20 or something like that?
Maybe. I'll put the link in the description. And they had like an outline of what the apartment would look like. So there was three rooms where they weren't allowed in whatsoever. Their dad forbid it. And that was the parents' room, the living room, like, you know, the dining room with like the TV and stuff. And there was another toilet, like a bathroom, right. And there was two bathrooms next to each other, and they had one for the kids and one for like him, pretty much just for him.
Yeah. King of the castle, isn't he?
King of the castle. And yeah, so obviously there's like, you know, seven guys in there. No, not seven guys. There's six guys, one girl and the mum. You know, they're like, you know, get up in the morning and they do their business and stuff.
Nope, it's a long queue.
Yeah, it's a hell of a long queue. Yeah, and the reason why the dad forbid this was because the living room and their bedroom were on the opposite sides of the apartment, and they were like touching, you know, adjacent to other apartments in the building. And he didn't want the noise from the other apartments to influence the kids in any way. He didn't want he didn't obviously want to like, you know, have them playing around in that room. So there could be, I guess, noise complaints. That might be a thing.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I would look at that more as like, just again, looking it through the dad's eyes of, he doesn't want the outside world seeping in. Like, again, he doesn't want it to cloud his children's minds, that he is basically, he's molded their minds to a degree, or he believes he has. That's how I would look at that personally. I would think he doesn't want the outside world seeping in.
Plus, in an apartment with nine people in it, like, it, I think it's more for him in terms of he, you know, because there's lots of times in the documentary where he's just like hiding out in like his bedroom or like the living room.
Yeah. Like his own space away from all the noise and carry on, I guess. Like,
yeah.
His little bit of freedom. Like he's so much about freedom, and that's his little bit of freedom, even away from his own family.
I mean, yeah, he's still a bit of a, you know, a bit of a bastard for doing this, I think. But
oh yeah, no doubt. Like 100%. Why?
Like, I think you do see in this room in the documentary at some point. It's the one with the two TVs. There's like two TVs next to each other, and it looks like he's watching a film on one and the news on the other one.
Yeah.
So I watched the interview with the director, and she said how she discovered them was she was just like walking through New York, and all of a sudden, like one of the brothers run past her, and then like another one, and then another one, and then she was like, what's going on here? They, you know, they all look kind of really, but like strange looking. They're all wearing like, you know, the Ray-Bans. And so she just like feels like compelled to follow them. So she follows them and like meets them at like a crossing. And she asks them, like, are you all brothers? You know, cause I mean, they all look alike anyway, like quite a lot. And she gets to know them, and she was like, but, you know, they find out she's a director, so that's the coolest thing ever for them. You know, meeting like a film director. And slowly, like over the course of like, what, like 5 months? It, apparently from meeting them to actually going around to their place, to their apartment to start filming, that was 5 months. And the whole documentary overall took 5 years to make. And as much as she, because I thought at first, to be honest, when I first watched the documentary, I thought the dad had died, and that's why, you know, they're out and about and stuff now.
Yeah.
That's what I got from the first impression. I was really surprised to see him in the documentary when I first seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered why he wasn't shown, but she apparently was, she didn't think she would, she, you know, she didn't want to put him on there at the beginning. But so apparently it was like years later when she, you know, the chat where he has a conversation and he says like, oh, you know, my superpower is influencing everybody. And there's a few other bits where he's having like, you know, sit down talk with her and have, you know, talking to the camera. And that's years after she's been filming this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it took a long time, which that's why I like it so much. Cause it feels kind of like a natural progression overall from,
oh, definitely.
Yeah. From them kind of just,
it's good filmmaking. It's definitely good filmmaking. But again, like I wonder if a degree of that might have been with the father as well, like a kind of trust thing, you know, like let's say, what did you say, after 3 years was when he kind of like came into it?
I'm not too sure about, it was a couple of years. Like he was in it. I know that the mum trusted her and stuff from the get-go. They, you know, they kind of still talked to her and that.
Again, you can understand that with the portrait of this father character that you get through the documentary, you can understand that he at first would be completely distrusted, because again, it's the outside world coming in. It's everything he's kind of steered his family against for so long. But you know, there came a point, like not long after Mukunda first went out when he was 15, not long after that, the other brothers followed. Like they obviously saw, like, wow, he's doing this and he's getting away with it. He's not dead. He's gone out into that world and he's not dead. So, you know, that made them kind of think, well, if he can do it, why can't we? And then they started going out more as a group. And you get a sense that the father, like, because I thought at first, oh, the father is going to go ape shit. Like, you know, there's going to be some repercussion for this. Like, something bad is going to happen. But it doesn't. Like, you just get a sense of the father losing control and kind of his grip on them reins that he had for so long are being loosened. That's what I take from it. And it's almost like the fall of him. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's almost like his pride has been diminished, and like as a man, and especially a man like he obviously is, that with such a hold of control over his family, to then lose that control, like the kind of young lion stepping up to the old lion, that's what comes across to me. And like he almost cowers in it to a degree, which shows that he, you know, he's tried to come across as this big, strong, scary individual all of his children's lives, but then they've realized that he's not that. Like he's a scared old man. That's what I take from it anyway. Like, kind of like you just see the losing of control, and he kind of goes within himself a bit after that, I think.
He couldn't keep this up forever. It's not like, you know, when they're all like, say, 30 years old, you know, like fully grown and stuff like that. It's,
no, exactly.
It's too much. He probably, I don't know. It's one thing
I think a degree he probably thought he could. I think there was a time where he thought that, okay, like, because like it comes across like he wanted a little community within a community. And I think it even, I think one of the kids in the documentary state that he said he was God. He would like to be known as God. Like, and that again is like this massive control aspect. But yeah, I think it came to a point where I don't think he ever thought his children would stand up. I think he thought he would always be in control. But you know, as anyone gets older, you know, your parents lose that control over you, you know, because you become an adult and, you know, you have to experience the good and the bad of the world for yourself to make any way through the world. You know, because if you don't, if you're mollycoddled your whole life, you're not going to do very well in the world, without that safety blanket of your parents, you know? So it's almost like it's a rite of passage for every human being.
I found it really strange how these two people, the parents, met whilst traveling. They mm-hmm. met whilst traveling, and they seem like kind of people who, the mum seemed like really outgoing. She, you know, she's traveling the world. She wanted to see like South America. And I think I read that they met on around Machu Picchu.
All right, yeah.
On the trail of that. And I guess he was one of the guides at that point, and that's how they met.
Mm-hmm.
And for someone to go from, like, you know, wanderlust, you know, traveling and stuff like that, to be more or less being confined to an apartment for, like, what, 13 years or maybe longer?
Yeah.
It just seems, I just don't understand how.
It's control, and it's like, to a degree, it's Stockholm syndrome. You know, like if she, you know, at first, again, we don't really know enough about the father's forms of control with the mother. Like it doesn't go deep enough into that. Like, and obviously I don't want to speculate, you know, because I don't know. But
he did say he did hit her, like there was slaps and stuff. Like, yeah, it's in the documentary.
There you go. And that's all it's going to take sometimes, yeah. You know, and it's horrible. But people can be beat down so much that their whole being, their whole person that they were, becomes something different. And to rally in the mold that this person wants them to be. And you know, that happens in a lot of like domestic abuse cases. You know, you find a lot of people will question with, say, someone that's involved in a relationship that where there's domestic abuse involved. And some people will say, well, why don't they just leave? And it's not as easy as that. Like, your life becomes that square box is your life, and that's all it becomes. And then it becomes scary to even think about leaving that. Like, that's the kind of horrible power that domestic abuse holds over the person being abused. It's heartbreaking.
It's horrible when you think about it. Like, considering that she didn't talk to her mum for like all this time as well. Remember, like, she has a phone call to her mum. She's like turning 88 years old tomorrow, and she's been like, I guess, forbidden to contact her parents in that time, or like any family, I guess.
Yeah, but again, that stems to that point of the person doing the controlling is like, well, if they have that link to the outside world, that's an opportunity of them escaping. And he doesn't want to let go of them reins. Like, his bubble is perfect for him. You know, everything within that bubble suits his needs. So in his mind, he's built this perfect little life that he wanted for himself, even if he is in what he would class as maybe a cesspool of where he lives, and not liking the outside of where he lives, and wanting, I think he says he originally wanted that to be almost like a stopgap and go to Scandinavia, and just, he said the way of life is better there. Like, he has this almost dream view of what he thinks life should be, and he's got stuck. But if he's stuck where he is, then he's gonna have within those four walls, he's going to have that dream view within those four walls. Like, it's all psychological, definitely. It's so psychological.
Yeah, I was going to say that about the whole, as soon as, if she's in contact with family, then they can see that, you know, the family can say, hey, you know, he's not right for you. He's, you know, abusing you. And
well, they could come and collect her. They could come bang down the door and be like, you're leaving with us now. Bring the kids.
Yeah, they don't. And they probably don't know where she was. Like, well, I mean, I think in the documentary, it shows that they don't know where she was for like these years.
Exactly.
And that's what's insane. So I would say as much as a part of it is keeping the kids and, you know, the family, you know, inside, it's not so much like, it's because once, as long as they're in that apartment, they're together.
Mm-hmm.
I think the dad thinks that if he can keep the mum and the kids in the apartment, then there's no possibility of her eventually leaving him.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he eliminates the threat. He, you know, they cut off all the family and stuff like that. It's like, as you said, like they're in that perfect little bubble. Well, he's in that perfect little bubble. You know, yeah, they're not.
It all suits his needs completely. And again, like, I guess you could also look at it as by keeping the kids in and, you know, getting them to follow his control orders and stuff like that, that's almost as well like a weapon against the mother, because the mother's not going to leave their children. Well, I suppose they do in life, you know, I can't broadly stroke that, like, but generally, you know, a mother has a different bond with their child than what the father does. The mother carried that child. The mother gave birth to that child. It's different. It's a stronger bond. So again, I would say he looks at, by keeping them under kind of lock and key, is another tool to keep the mother there. But yeah, it's pretty deep stuff.
I like the bit where they're going out to see their first film. Mm-hmm. And they go and see The Fighter, I think it was, and they're like, oh, I'm gonna remember this night for a long, long time. And I love how just before they go out, the mum essentially says to all of them, like, you know, one by one, have a good night, all that stuff. It's not like kind of addressing the whole group, it's literally just one by one, like looking, like, give them a kiss, saying have a good night, you know, make, you know, approach people if you want to approach people.
Yeah.
It's because she wanted this lifestyle for them. She says at one point in the documentary, she wouldn't mind, you know, going to places where there's like, you know, greenery and, you know, they can run around, and it's not what she wanted. Definitely.
No, exactly. Because she's experienced that life. Like you were saying before, like how she used to live a life of wanderlust, and then she got conformed to this new way of life. And then she was watching her own children grow up without all those wonderful things of the world that she grew up with. And that for her must have been absolutely heartbreaking as a mother, watching your children and feeling like you're a part of that to a degree as well. Because she is to a degree, but also she's just as much locked down as what the kids are. Like, again, it stems back to the father and this controlling aspect of it. But yeah,
I think she did an amazing job, though. Like, the kids seem very intelligent. They're very well-spoken.
They're clued up. No doubt about it.
She's done an amazing job homeschooling them. I think the movies fill in, like, the blanks overall, but...
Well, I noticed one thing in the documentary as well is, obviously, after... Mukunda first went out and the police came to him. When they approached him and were asking him, you know, who are you? What are you doing here? Why are you dressed up like this? You know, where are you from? He was catatonic. He couldn't speak. I think this might be in the TED Talks that he's done in the last few years. And he says he was completely catatonic. He didn't know how, although he was perfectly articulate in normal life within his four walls, at that point right then, he didn't know how to speak to other people. He didn't know how to communicate. So he was silent. And because of that, the police ended up taking him, I think, to the hospital. And he ended up going to a psych ward. And then progressively through that, once he was let home and that, him and his siblings saw a therapist, which some of them, I mean, it goes into this in the documentary, which some of them didn't mind and others obviously absolutely hated. And they felt that they would just say what they felt they needed to say to get through it. There's parts even within that part in the documentary where they're talking about the therapy sessions. I think Mukunda says about there's even been talk about sending them to proper school, and all of them are dead set against it. And I looked at that as very much so Stockholm syndrome, like almost they're taking on an aspect of their own father, because they say if they went to like real school, then it would mean their mother would be out of a job. And she would have to go and work out there. And they say it with disdain, like out there on the streets. And like, I got from that, like, whoa, like it's almost like a complete turnaround. Like their father's own thoughts are so deeply embedded into them that they're actually thinking that themselves at this point. Obviously that's changed since, which is a great thing. Whether that be through a continuation of therapy or just from experiencing the outside world more. But yeah, I looked at that as a massive like Stockholm syndrome type of thing there.
Yeah, like as he says, over my dead body.
Yeah.
And that's what I liked about that bit, because it felt like it was kind of the real personalities breaking through the cracks, because I do feel like they have like personas and stuff in there. Like they do have the movie personas that they act in almost like it's like a film and stuff.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, like a couple of elements where real heartfelt moments and stuff come through. And it's, those are the bits I love about this. You know, they used to pretend to be someone else all these years. And then once, you know, they're opened up long enough, you know, these things seep out.
Yeah, like they have to be real in those moments. Like there's no script for that part. Like there's nothing they can't stick a VHS in and write down word for word what to say at these moments. Like it's real. It's from the heart. Like, yeah, like brilliant. It, again, goes down to what I'd say, like fantastic filmmaking, editing, and just getting this whole thing made. I think it's a fantastic documentary on so many levels.
Yeah, I think the director stumbled across like the most amazing documentaries. She's seen like this kind of something out of the ordinary and she just chased after it.
Did you know that like not long after the documentary originally came out, that people thought it was a hoax?
No.
Like they thought the whole thing was set up. Like I read that earlier today, and there's a lot of like different posts saying that you know, certain people thought it was a hoax, and because it's just so good, like it's almost an unbelievable tale. But it's not. I'm sure this goes on even to this day in households around the world. It's just you never hear of it, because a lot of the time this person in control keeps hold of that control. Or if they don't, like a lot of people probably don't want to talk about it once they've escaped it. You know, that's over there. That's a part of their life they maybe, you know, don't want to make public. But again, like, yeah, like when I read that earlier, I was like, yeah, a lot of people thought it was one massive hoax, like that it was written. And then, like, of watching the documentary again this evening, like, I was trying to, when it first started, I was almost looking at it through those eyes and thinking, wow, it is almost too perfect. I don't think it's a hoax. Like, I'm not on that bandwagon at all. But I can totally understand, like, after reading that and then watching it again, I can totally understand why people would think so. But I don't think it's a case of it's a hoax. I think maybe people thought, oh, well, that's shot too well for that to be just a homemade thing. But a lot of the movie scenes in that, like, it's not from their camcorder. It's from the documentary filmmaker filming them doing it. So, of course, it's going to look professional. But, yeah, I found that quite interesting.
Yeah, I can see where people are coming from that, because they're all film buffs. They could easily choose, like, a mutual story to tell, like, about their upbringing and stuff. But, I mean...
Or even the filmmaker the filmmaker sees this group of brothers walking down the street. Well, they look cool as fuck in their, you know, sunglasses and suits. They look like characters from Reservoir Dogs. You know, that it's, you could understand like a filmmaker seeing that and going, okay, there's money to be made here. Again, I'm not on that bandwagon.
No, I don't think it's that.
You can see why people would think that.
So the documentary comes out in 2015 and then wins the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival.
Well deserved.
Which is, yeah, exactly. I think this is one that was definitely hyped about for quite a while before it came out. I remember seeing the trailer for this before it came out. I was like, I have to see this film. I have to see it. Mm-hmm. So it's been 5 years since the documentary came out. What has happened to them since, Matt?
What has happened to them since?
Tell you everything. I know that you've made some notes on what's happened since.
Yeah, I mean, like, I've done a bit of browsing today, and there's really not a lot. There's not a lot at all.
I found that as well, because it does feel like it, from when the documentary came out, like 2015 to 2016, there's stuff, like there's interviews galore, and then there's nothing really after that.
Yeah, it just kind of fades into darkness. But like the kind of most recent thing that I've seen was a tweet from Mukunda, and it's from as of today, about 3 days ago. And it's a tweet on an interview he's had for a website. And if you want to read the interview, like it's a fairly good read, not too long. Just go to @MukundaAngelo. All one word. And yeah, he's got a little kind of like promotion for the interview. And it's for the website Bustle. And he kind of talks about the current situation in the world, you know, people being in quarantine, how like he kind of lived that life. Like he had a quarantine of his own before quarantine became cool to a degree. But yeah, he speaks a lot in that about things. I wrote a little quote of something he said that I thought like stood out to me at least. He said that it seems like what people are scared of more than anything else is money, which is not really something the human body needs to live. You just need food, shelter, and company. That's what sucks at times like this, that even when the whole world has one common enemy, the coronavirus, money is still a big issue. Can you imagine if the end of the world did happen? Would we still use money, or would we say, you know what, this shit just isn't worth it? Let's just help each other. Like, and I just looked at that as like a, like it shows his kind of mindset towards the world. And it kind of goes on within that to kind of just like, because apparently a lot of people have said to him, well, you know, you should be used to this quarantine. You've been through it. But he kind of goes on to say, yeah, there's a difference between, like, his quarantine was completely forced upon him and his family as children. Like it was, that was the big fear in his life, was to step outside. Whereas now, like, at least within this quarantine, he was like, you're allowed to exercise. It's like, there's numbers to call if you're struggling with your mental health. You know, there's things out there for help. He had none of that. Him and his family had none of that. But yeah, I just found it a really interesting read. Like I say, it's not too long. Worthwhile taking a look at. But I also saw it, like most of the stuff I've seen is from him. There doesn't appear to be a lot from any of the other siblings. I've heard that the mum and the sister are currently quarantining together. The dad's out of the picture. He's alive, as far as I know, but the mum and dad have split. I'm guessing that probably came from the documentary. Maybe she followed suit with the rest of her family. But yeah, so they're quarantining together. There's not really much at all on the sister at all. There's not much info at all. Just the fact that, you know, she has this, like, disorder that she was born with. It's called Turner syndrome, and from what I've looked up, it's a condition that affects only females, and it results when one of the X chromosomes is missing or partially missing. It can cause like developmental problems such as short height, a failure of the ovaries to develop properly, and later on in life can lead to heart failure. So that's pretty horrible, like for her, like especially if she's been confined in all of her childhood anyway, and remembering that she's the eldest sibling. So she, I presume, would have been within that life longer than any of the others. And the fact that she's got this disorder, this Turner syndrome, like, and the fact that it could end her life short, that's pretty heartbreaking. But yeah, I saw another kind of interview. I saw it through YouTube with Mukunda, and he kind of describes about what the brothers are all doing like nowadays. Like Mukunda, and this was from a couple of years ago, so it could have changed since. But again, it's all I could find. But Mukunda now works as a part of a freelance film and TV crew, so like he's helped like make movies and things like that, which kind of goes hand in hand with what he's enjoyed in life. But yeah, like I thought that was kind of cool. I'm trying to think what somebody he said some of the other siblings done.
Is it Govinda?
Yeah,
he the one that I think moves out in the documentary, the one that they're shown taking the couch up the stairs for him, and yeah, he's like the first one to move out. I see that he has done a fair bit, like on according to IMDb he was in Nerve in 2016.
All right, yeah.
Like as a just an actor in the background, I think. But then he's mainly done like camera assistant stuff. Like he's been like, yeah, second camera assistant on and like first camera assistant on documentaries and TV shows, and he's done a fair bit. Like the one that
I think he's done like commercials and things as well.
Yeah, there's the Humans of New York series. Remember, you know, yeah, where they take pictures of you in New York and then they like discuss their story and stuff.
Yeah,
like, yeah. There's a series of it, like a TV series.
And, oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah, he's a camera operator in that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's done like, yeah, a fair bit. I did look through.
I think the one of the other twins, I'm probably butchering his name, Narayana. Yeah. And he became an environmentalist, and I think you see parts of it in the documentary. But he's at a company called Nightberg, and it's a company that got fracking banned in New York City, and he was a part of that.
Yeah, because you see the protest. You see a protest in you at the beginning, like, or yeah, no, I mean the end of the documentary, him like protesting, yeah, fracking.
And I think that's a pretty cool thing to have done. You know, fracking seems to be pretty destructive in the world. Like, so yeah, to be able to say that you've had a hand in stopping that in a certain place, in the place you grew up, like I'd say that's pretty cool. But it also said that he also works part time at a indie theater, and it's called the Metrograph, yeah, and I think that's in New York City too. But yeah, like I thought that was pretty cool. Just a few things, really. And Bhagavan, what name? We know that name well. like, he's a part of or at least was, I don't know if he still is, but was part of a dance group. And they basically do, like, dance shows, but of, like, classic stories. So I think he said that he'd done, like, stuff like Beauty and the Beast, you know, some Shakespearean things, but almost telling the stories through the interpretation of dance within this dance group. And I think he's got a Twitter as well. It's not very up to date from what I saw, but a lot of his posts are through, like, they're almost like retweets of this theater company that I saw.
Wasn't he a yoga teacher kind of as well?
Dance.
He was.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I remember seeing that on, I don't know if it was at the end of the documentary, or was it like the stuff I researched since? I think, yeah, because you see him doing yoga, as far as I can tell, like at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they say, hey, Spider-Man.
There's, I mentioned it earlier, but there's a TED Talks on YouTube with Mukunda, about 16 minutes long, 16 minutes or so. And it kind of generally, like to begin with, starts out with him basically explaining like what you've seen in the documentary, like his life, what he grew up with. But then he goes on to say that after the documentary and after going to like the film festivals and things, like they got to travel and they got to go to Europe. Like they went to London, they walked across, you know, the Beatles, is it Abbey Road? Yeah. And they got to do that, which was obviously a huge thing for them. So they got to kind of experience what their mum experienced in her early life, which I thought was quite a nice kind of ending to the story. But yeah, one thing that stood out to me in the TED Talks was like a thing that, that Mukunda ended on. And it's this like quote here. And the name of the TED Talks itself is How My Imagination Set Me Free. As I say, you can find it on YouTube. But yeah, this quote, I really liked at the end. It was, before I walked out of that front door, my imagination was the only place I felt I was free. Now I'm out in the world doing all these things I dreamed of doing. It's better than anything I could have imagined. Imagination isn't just a fairy tale or a fantasy. It's you. It's who you are. It's the power within you. Don't ever let anyone take that away from you. Believe in it, nurture it. Your imagination is your freedom. And I just thought that was quite powerful, and kind of goes hand in hand for like all of their lives growing up and what got them through, you know, these kind of strange circumstances that they were living within. But yeah, I thought that was quite a powerful note for him to end that TED Talk on.
He seems like a powerful writer so far. I mean, like, that last quote you shared with us about from the website, the article, and this one.
Yeah.
If he's not writing a book, like an autobiography on this whole thing, then he needs to be. Yeah, he definitely needs to be. He has a way with words.
Like, did you know I've not seen too much about it, but initially after the documentary came out as well, they started their own almost like film company, like production company.
The Wolfpack.
And I think
is it Wolfpack Productions or something? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that really went anywhere. I'd love for them to make a movie. Like, I just think they're through their childhood and growing up, their imaginations are so wild that I think they could really create something special.
I just feel like every one of them could be like Michel Gondry. Like, you know, his style of films where it's kind of like super hands-on, like using loads of props and, you know, like paper and stuff. Yeah, just insane. I mean, I don't know if you've seen Science Asleep, but I feel like if they made a film, it'd be that. Science Asleep is so good.
Absolutely crazy film, but fantastic.
I feel like if they made a film, that would be it. It would be Science Asleep, or just any Michel Gondry film, apart from maybe Eternal Sunshine and stuff. Like, yeah, or his most recent.
That's my favorite, though. That's my favorite.
I did see some of the stuff they did. Like, there were some promos they did for around when the documentary came out, and they remade some of the films at the time. Like, was it Grand Budapest Hotel by Wes Anderson?
Oh, yeah.
And there was, like, a few others, and I was like, oh, wow, this is amazing. Like, one of my favorite directors, Wes Anderson, and they look spot on as well. Like,
I would be really interested if they would release these films that they've made, like, on YouTube or whatever. I'd happily sit and watch them, even though it's basically a carbon copy of something we've probably already seen.
Yeah.
But even what you see in the documentary itself, like, it's so interesting to watch, and just how they have it down to a T, literally just filmed in their little apartment. It's absolute pure creativeness, and I think it's incredible.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. I would definitely subscribe to it if there was a YouTube where they have uploaded these videos and stuff too. I haven't found that yet, so if there is one,
no, me neither.
If we do find one between now and when this podcast comes out, I'll link it in the show notes, like everything else I've mentioned so far this episode. All right, that is it for this week's episode, I think. Thanks for listening. If you haven't hit us up on our socials, hit us up on those socials. Follow us on Twitter and at .. You can find us on Facebook just by searching us. You can find us on Instagram as well, .. And that's it, I think. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Hello.
Boop, boop, boop.